Let's open our Bibles to Numbers chapter 20, where I think the saddest story of Moses' life is told. And that is where he gets himself in trouble and loses the blessing of going into the promised land. And this is the way it transpired, and I think we need to start at the very context, beginning of the context, in chapter 20, verse 1. The people, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh. I locate Kadesh in the area of the modern Israeli community of Paran. It's on the west side of the valley that stretches from the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba all the way up to the bottom of the Dead Sea. And this is the southern boundary of the Promised Land, and it is the place that they were at roughly 38 years earlier when the penalty wandering period began. So they've made full circle. And then we read that Miriam died there and was buried there. So it's the beginning of the 40th year of the Exodus. The generation that is going to die in the wilderness is mostly gone. There's only a little bit of it left. And here is Miriam, probably the oldest person in the entire assembly of Israel. She dies somewhere in her 120s, I would guess, and is buried outside the Promised Land. Verse 2, now there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses and said, would that we'd perished when our brothers perished before he who is. So these guys are griping about the fact that this is a desolate region. There's no natural water apparently here, no surface water. And they figure they would have been better off to have already died. Verse 4, why have you brought the assembly of he who is into this wilderness, that we should die here, both we and our cattle? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It's no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates. There's no water to drink. So they're griping that this isn't the Promised Land, and they're blaming Moses for it. And as I said yesterday, it gets under Moses' skin. Even though these guys are being faithless against God, they are verbalizing it in such a way that Moses takes it personally. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting. They fell on their faces, and the glory of he who is appeared to them. And he who is spoke to Moses, saying, take the staff, remember the power staff that's been a snake and has also produced almonds, and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron your brother, tell the rock, tell, verbalize, speak to, the rock before their eyes to yield its water, and so you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle. And he's done this before to work with a rock that shouldn't produce water, and it does. And so Moses took the staff from before he who is as he commanded him, and then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. So up to this point, Moses and Aaron have done exactly what needed to happen. And then it goes off the rails. He, meaning Moses, said to them, hear now, you rebels! Shall we bring water for you out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice. And then water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their livestock. And so it sounds like the crisis has been dealt with. The people that have been griping about water have plenty of it. They're not going to die of thirst out here. And yet, Moses crossed the line. Now, commentators will give different reasons why God penalizes Moses. I'm going to kind of give you both because I think it might actually be a little bit of both. First of all, and I think this is the most significant one, is that Moses acted out of anger about his own feelings, about his perception that these guys were not treating him with respect and properly, and that he had to do this for them. And that didn't give proper glory to God. And then the second thing is that he actually physically strikes the rock twice, even though God had only said to speak to the rock. And some commentators make a point that Jesus is identified as being represented by this rock. That's very clear from 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul does that. And that Jesus was only struck once for sin, not twice, not multiple times. And that when Moses did this, he took away some of the power of the symbolism of Jesus as the rock that was struck and gave up the water of life. And so I think there's a good reason to feel that that is part of it too. And so I'm more prone to focus on didn't give glory part, got all hyper for himself, but I am well ready to acknowledge the other is significant as well. And so this is what happens. And this is the sad, sad part of the story. So he who is said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me. Now, they believe in God. So I think it might have been helpful for our English Standard version people to have translated this with the other shade of meaning for this word, and that is trust. Because you did not trust me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. So God tells both Moses and Aaron, we usually focus on Moses, but Aaron gets penalized here too, that they don't get to go into the promised land because they didn't hold God up as the glorious one in this procedure. So it feels like a very minor thing, and yet it was apparently a very big deal, because God was not held up as the one that makes the rules, and those rules need to be followed. I'm always prompted to use an example from my teaching years at this point. When I was teaching in the Christian school, I had great students, but remember, they were elementary age kids. And you know how elementary age kids are, especially when you're talking about, I think at this time we might have been second graders, maybe third graders. And they can sometimes be rambunctious. And I had three main rules for my class. Raise your hand, wait your turn, listen, think, learn, three strikes, and you're out. So that was my basic rule structure for my students, to try to keep them focused on the work for each day. One particular day, it was bad. I don't know if the moon was full or whatever it was, but everybody was breaking rules. There were quite a few names on the board with strikes next to them, and I think there might have even been a couple of strikeouts that were going to lose some time for their recess. And I finally reached the limit of my patience. And I said very loudly, the next one of you that does not raise their hand before they speak will lose their entire recess. Now, typically, I would only take like 5 or 10 minutes of a recess for striking out. But I was frustrated. And so I made that rule firm and fast. And it couldn't have been just a few minutes later and my star student, the young lady who was always compliant, always obedient, always did her best, picked that day to speak without raising her hand. And I was left with no choice. I had stood there in front of my class and pronounced very clearly, next person that does the breaking of the rule will lose the entire recess. And I had to tell her, I'm sorry, you don't get to go to recess. Even to this day, I kind of tear up over it because it broke my heart. And just like it broke her heart, she cried big time. And I understand that. But the rule had been laid down in front of everybody, and it had to be followed. That's the situation here, I think. It may have seemed like a little thing that Moses got mad and yelled at the people, why do we have to do these things for you? And struck the rock twice. But it did not respect God, and it showed that disrespect in front of everybody. And God needed to show, you can't do that. That can't be allowed, even if you are the leader that has served me well for 40 years. I cannot allow you to be seen to get away with that. So God puts the penalty on him. And when we get to the book of Deuteronomy, Moses will still be not very happy with the people and blame them for the fact that he doesn't get into the promised land. So he feels cheated by their actions prompting his action. Now, this gives the place a secondary name. We're at Kadesh Barnea, but the water gets a specific name. It says here in verse 13, these are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarreled with He who is, and through them He showed Himself holy. So Meribah means contention or argument. It's almost a legal sort of thing. This name pops up in other places, in the Psalms in particular, that become important to us. And I want to go to a couple of those. Go to Psalm 95, and it's going to be down in verse 8 that this pops up. It says, actually, verse number 7, let's start in there. And this is quoted in the book of Hebrews later. For He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture, the sheep of His hand. Today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation. Now, loathed as in got really irritated with, and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways, and therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. So the attitude we saw of the people at the beginning of Numbers chapter 20, where they're just grumping and griping, even though for 40 years God has cared for them, brought them out of Egypt miraculously, and has provided them, even during their time out, food and water and shelter and health and kindness and compassion and mercy, they still gripe about every little thing that doesn't go the way they want. And so that's why this place gets that name, and that attitude is why they ended up with the timeout in the first place. And It's also in another psalm, and I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly which psalm it is now. You can run your own little checks on it, though. In another psalm, it talks about how Moses got penalized at Meribah because of the attitude of the people and how sad that is. All right, so let's go back to Numbers chapter 20, verse 14. And it says that Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Now, Edom is just across the valley from where I believe Kadesh Barnea is located, about 20 miles. So we're really, really close to the border. In fact, a place that is part of the country of Edom is fairly well known to us, even to this day. It's called the city of Petra, the red rose rock city of Petra. Well, that's about 18 miles as the crow flies east of where I think these guys are encamped right now. And it is along the eastern side of Petra that the ancient King's Highway trade route ran. This trade route came from the Nile Delta across the northern Sinai to Ezion Gabor, the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. And then it went north from there, about 50 or so miles in that valley. And then it zagged off to the northeast, past Petra, and along through the major thoroughfare of the country of Edom, up through Bozra, that we know is one of the key cities in the kingdom of Edom. Well, Moses would like to take the people of Israel across the valley and then zigzag up into where Petra is located. There's some paths that are there. And then jump on this major thoroughfare and zoom up through Edom in a matter of days, and then up through Moab, and then hang a hard left on the north side of Moab, down into the valley of Jordan, across from Jericho. That's the path he wants to take, so that they can be in the promised land in a matter of weeks. But that's not the way it's going to play out. This is what happens. Verse 14 again. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, and the reason he uses that language is because the Israelis are direct descendants of Jacob, while the Edomites are direct descendants of Esau. And Jacob and Esau were the twin sons of Isaac, the twin grandsons of Abraham. So the Israelis and the Edomites are brother nations. So thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that we have met, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we lived in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and our fathers, and we cried to He who is, and He heard our voice and sent an angel, this messenger, the Holy Spirit actually, and brought us out of Egypt. And here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your territory. And as I explained to you, the location that I have for Kadesh is like right on the border. So please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or vineyard or drink water from a well. We will go along the King's Highway. See, this is a well-known trade route of the ancient world. we will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we've passed through your territory. So Moses is making the offer here. I know I've got a big bunch of people, but we will store all of the supplies we need, water included, so that we can go walking right along the king's highway through your territory without ever having to stop for filling up our water containers or anything like that. We'll be through in a matter of days and gone. That's the guarantee that I will make to you if you'll just give us special permission to pass through. Now, this trade route, this King's Highway, was used all the time by trade caravans. But trade caravans are not 600,000 men strong. And so that's why Moses is asking for special consideration. Now, remember, Miriam died in the first month, it would appear. That's at least when they arrived at Kadesh Barnea. They probably grieved over her for about a month. And then the next month or so, they might have stuck around at Kadesh Barnea while this exchange goes back and forth between Moses and the king of Edom. Because it takes a little while to do these back and forths. So here's the first response from Edom. Verse 18, Edom said to him, "You shall not pass through, lest I come out with the sword against you." So Edom is not thrilled with this idea of this huge group coming through, this armed group. And so he says, "No, if you come this direction, I will assume that you're coming to do harm, and we will meet you with military force." Verse 19, the people of Israel said back to him, "We will go up by the highway, and if we drink your water, I and my livestock, then I will pay for it. Let me only pass through on foot, nothing more." So earlier, he seemed to indicate they wouldn't need to drink any of the water. Now, maybe in response to concerns that he thinks the Edomites have, is, look, even if for some reason we might need to fill up a little water here and there, we will pay you whatever you want, value-wise, for that water, so that you do not lose anything. Message comes back, verse 20. He said, "You shall not pass through." And this time he backs it up with action. Edom came out against them with a large army and with a strong force. So the Edomites get together a good, significant military militia call-up. And they come down and they basically blockade the trade route, probably right around Petra. Because that's the entry point for Edom on the King's Highway. And so they blockade it there with a clear indicator, if you even try to come this direction, we will attack. We will defend our land. And so, verse 21 reports, thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory, so Israel turned away from him. And that is fair, because Edom is a sovereign territory, and they have the right to decide who travels through their territory, and in this case, they don't want the Israelis coming through. Now, why does God not intervene? I don't know, because he certainly could have told the Edomites, "You will let them go through," but he doesn't. It may be that he is fine with them spending a little bit more time going around the long way, because we still have to wait for the last remnants of that sinful generation to pass away. Remember, it's the 40th year still, so those guys, at least some of them, are still alive. Verse 22 says, so they journeyed from Kadesh, and the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. Now, Mount Hor becomes significant because that is where Aaron is going to die. Now, where is Mount Hor? Nobody knows for sure, but I find it interesting that the tomb of Aaron, from very ancient tradition, is located at the top of the mountain that is a little bit west and a little bit southwest of Petra. And you can look this up in different sources, that's where the traditional tomb of Aaron is located. So it may be that what happened is that while Moses was engaged in these negotiations, that's when they actually moved their encampment from Kadesh Barnea over to the edge, the very, very edge of Edomite territory, still in the valley, but butting up against this ridgeline that you can see very prominently. If you've got something like Google Earth, by the way, you can see this clear. Just find the place where Petra is at and find the place where the traditional tomb of Aaron is at. And they can be in a flat area in the valley on the west side of this ridge right next to Petra. And that's where the command then comes for Moses to take Aaron up to the top of this mountain, which is the actual technical border with Edom. And that's where Moses is going to say goodbye to his big brother, just 3 years older than him. And Aaron will be the next member of this family that dies outside the Promised Land. But we're out of time for today, so we will save that story until tomorrow, when we, with God's grace, will get back into the Word.